Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hello and welcome to Dirty Water, back from a six-month hiatus, disappeared via a mixture of laziness and mortal fear of work. I'm Derek Riley, I'm a Charlie Smith, and today's guest is a surfer, war crimes investigator, and author of Tie Sticks, Surfers, Scammers, and the Untold Story of the Marijuana Trade, Law and War, a book about the Nuremberg Trials, Facing Death in Cambodia, and Breathe, the new bio and jiu-jitsu icon, Hicks and Gracie. Ain't much you can't do. Our guest made a fine cameo on Beach Grit 1 week ago, with a piece on the chaotic American withdrawal from Afghanistan. He describes Washington, D.C. as a shit show, his own books as extremely depressing, developed a military rescue boat along with George Greeno, smoked approximately 1 ton of weed as a teenager, has multiple black belts in the martial arts, and gave Kelly Slater his first ever lesson in jiu-jitsu. And he's currently in the process of selling a screenplay on the discovery of G-Land. Our guest, Mr. Peter McGuire. Peter.
Derek, great to see you again. I think the last time I saw you was in about 1989 at the offices of the greatest surfing magazine ever published, Australian Surfing Life, with a great Mike Perry at the helm of it. And those were good innings, right?
Yeah, I think you must have tickled me in my cradle back then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Smacked me on the ass. So Peter, first of all, how about we dive into Afghanistan? I mean, does Joe Biden strike you as the right president at the right time, or a senile old son of a bitch who eats blended carrots and would rather be petting children?
Well, I don't think there's ever a right president. And basically, presidents get what they least want. And for example, George W. Bush wanted, you know, more or less disengagement and the America First thing. And then he got 9/11. And then he, you know, became the one who kicked this party off. Sleepy Joe, my wife best describes as 1 foot in the grave and 1 foot on a banana peel, is tippy at best. And it's sad because there are some great, you know, American political leaders like Senator Jim Webb, and many others. And they've been sidelined since 9/11, more or less. I mean, we're not all stupid.
Did you have any hope when America went into Afghanistan that it would turn out any different than the Soviet occupation? Or, I mean, no, did you think by sheer might we could fix it?
No, excellent question. The Soviets threw everything that they could at the Afghans. And one of my closest associates I worked with in Cambodia, Sylvain Vogel, he worked in Afghanistan during those years and in the tribal areas and had great contacts. And when I was in Phnom Penh, actually, when 9/11 happened, and when Vogel saw the road we were going down, he said, man, this is going to end very badly. I think the first real ill step is when we bombed a big wedding in the tribal area very early on, right after 9/11. And so, you know, the initial mission, you know, was to capture bin Laden, to flush out Al-Qaeda, all that. And we would have been largely successful at that. And interesting too, is one of the British elite commandos that I interviewed for my piece that you guys published, thank you. You know, he said, look, we had bin Laden's cave, you know, we had him cornered. And so, you know, this thing's been a shit show since the get-go. And so this Waterloo ending is actually very fitting and kind of provides an exclamation point to the ending of the so-called GWAT, the Global War on Terror, which, you know, which was a farce with, above all, you know, you go back to Clausewitz, Karl von Clausewitz, the great, you know, German or Prussian military theoretician who says that you know, policy is the brain, military might is the fist. And if the brain and the fist don't talk, you punch yourself in the face. And that's pretty much what we did. So what were our policy objectives in the GWAT was freedom, you know, democracy in Afghanistan, in a country that Alexander the Great, the British Empire at the height of its power, the Soviets, you know, playing every dirty game possible. I have some associates from Spotsnets who were, you know, were on the ground there, and they, you know, there were no holds barred. So if the Soviets couldn't do it, how are we going to do it? You know, and then we have our ragtag army of NGOs behind us saying, oh, we've got to teach this and women's liberation and this and that. And, you know, these are all good and fine things in a Western society. But when you start playing culture war games, you get in very perilous terrain. And I saw this in Cambodia during the UN occupation, the so-called UNTAC occupation after, you know, basically it was about 92, 93. And the Khmer Rouge still controlled a significant portion of the country. And the UN came in. They never, you know, militarily defeated the Khmer Rouge, but yet they set up all these social programs and all that. So they kind of tend to put the cart before the horse. And we certainly did that in Afghanistan.
Why was the withdrawal so chaotic, surely, with the amount of troops that America has and the might and all the toys? Why couldn't they secure?
Well, you know, to pull out your military before you pull out your diplomats, you know, and your fifth column of people that have helped you that you know are marked for death if you bail on them. I mean, like I said, my analogy wasn't Saigon, it was Phnom Penh. In the march of the Khmer Rouge into the capital, April 17th, 1975, you had any touch of the West, you were dead. That was it. You know, you were a so-called new person, and you were human cattle, livestock. You know, you were going to the killing fields. They're gonna, you know, in the Khmer Rouge, they killed, what was it, 2 million. In 3 years, 10 months, 20 days out of a population of about 10 million. But most were just worked to death. You know, there were plenty of executions, but most were simply died of starvation, dysentery, malaria, things of this nature. And so, you know, it's just incredibly short-sighted, incredibly sloppy to announce departure dates, to do all this stuff. I mean, look, the British SAS, I would argue the greatest military force in the world. They landed a Hercules in a dirt field in Kandahar and evacuated 20 SAS guys at night. So there's some, you know, there's some bad motherfuckers out there that are really, you know, getting it on. The French are getting it on and they're getting their nationals out. Like, there's no excuse. We've got DEVGRU, we've got Delta, we've got, you know, incredible warriors. But again, we don't have, as we've never had in the war on terror, we've never had good leadership. We've never had good policy. So that's what I would say.
do you have any hope for Taliban 2.0, a kinder, gentler Taliban?
Not really. No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, they are what they are. And the sad piece of the puzzle is that, you know, we didn't bring peace and stability. And so after 20 years, people yearn for that, and they, you know, they vacillate. And we may see that, you know, in our own country, where my prediction is we're going to lurch hard to the right because of, you know, just this weird anarchic, you know, where's America going forward? That's not my goal. That's not my hope, whatever else. But we're ourselves in a very strange time. So
It's a very natural reaction, though, to be pushed right when the majority population is pushed into a corner and marginalized. Don't you think? Same in Poland, absolutely. Hungary.
Well, when, you know, when, I mean, America has undergone a corporate cultural revolution. But for every revolution, there's often a counter-revolution. And a counter-revolution is brewing as a result of incompetence. I mean, we're seeing basic incompetence on the southern border. What is our policy on the southern border? We don't really have one. I mean, really, to be truly cynical, and Chaz is truly cynical, and you are too, Derek, so I'll throw this out there.
Skeptical, I mean, not cynical. There's a difference.
Yeah, but, you know, the probably the most efficient multinationals in the world right now are the Mexican cartels. And so perhaps, you know, we could make a deal to fly the Afghan refugees into Mexico and have the cartels handle their crossing into the U.S. because everybody else seems to be getting across. That's probably the most efficient way. And if you want to really read about the depths of how bad it is in the border areas, read Ed Vulliamy's book, Mexica. And Ed is an amazing British reporter, British newsman of the year, the best guy on the Bosnian War, was in Iraq and has spent huge amounts of time in Mexico and knows the cartels better than anyone. And, you know, how we in the post-NAFTA age of globalization and all that, you know, aided and abetted the cartels, it's just staggering. And that, you know, Wachovia, Wells Fargo, all these banks washed their dirty money. And after the Wall Street collapse, 2008, 2009, they were one of the few solvent, you know, solvent clients those banks had. So it was their solvency in many ways that propped up many of the American and also HSBC, the British bank. They all got busted for it, but they got a, you know, they got a slap on the wrist and a yellow card. So this speaks to something much larger and dirtier and more rotten.
Funny how America's mistakes are often the very most, I mean, Taliban, you know, essentially from the Mujahideen could be considered, I mean, easily an American creation, along with the cartels, along with like, how does not what we actually try to do work? What we are trying not to do is the thing that is like massively successful. It's wonderful.
Good intentions often yield the worst results, as, you know, Neville Chamberlain, you know, demonstrated with Peace in Our Time and, you know, with the Munich Agreement. So I'm wary of good intentions. I saw the, you know, the postmodern Lady Barbaras, you know, when I was in Cambodia, you know, and man Barbaras. It's not just women. I mean,
what do you mean by Lady Barbaras and man Barbaras?
It's George Bernard Shaw, you know, it's about, you know, these kind of well-intended people that, again, put the cart before the horse. You know, you can't, for example, in Cambodia, you can't sort of reestablish a society until you have a lasting, you know, military peace. You have a true winner. I mean, that's like, you know, I wrote a book about Nuremberg. The only reason Nuremberg was able to happen was Germany had an unconditional military surrender. And that's unique. You don't normally get that. You normally get a messy peace, a negotiated surrender, some backroom deals and things of this nature. And so that really was an anomaly. And in Cambodia, because the Khmer Rouge were such a powerful military force, even after they were chased out of the capital and everything else, and backed by the United States, China, you know, and Thailand. So 1979, after we knew the Khmer Rouge committed genocide, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, the Chinese and the Thais backed them to offset Vietnamese military gains. So this is the dirty chess game of international politics, Chaz. You know this. This isn't news to you. And we play this kind of, oh, America, we're the political virgins of the world. Oh, shocking. Oh, my gosh. You know, let me clutch my pearls. No, you know, we, you know, it went sideways for us in 1898 with the Spanish-American War. Right. So we beat the Spanish and they and then, you know, the Cubans say, oh, great. Thank you, American liberators, Philippines. Oh, thank you, Martin. And we say, well, not so much. You know, we're going to kind of send a few guys in there. We're going to, you know, you Philippines, gateway to Asia. So, you know, none of this is simple. And you know, international politics is a nasty game. As Bismarck said, do I want a badly used Napoleon or do I want a well used Napoleon? And those are the questions, whether it's Saddam Hussein, whether it's, you know, Massoud, the Lion of Panjshir, you know, I mean, you're making Faustian deals every step of the way. And yeah, so.
On branding, where do you put the Khmer Rouge? Like in terms of
branding.
On branding. Yep. Like I have in my branding catalog, Khmer Rouge right below Shining Path, way at the tip top of great branding, great marketing.
Number numero uno. Yeah, yeah. Funky boy. Yeah, older brother number one. Yeah, Pol Pot. Yeah, number one. Yeah, no, they the best, some of the most amazing footage I recovered was from the East Germans, who were the first camera crews into Cambodia. They went in with the Vietnamese and, yeah, I mean, it was all Chinese orchestrated and, you know, the Chinese were the sponsors of the whole thing. And, you know, the Chinese are our big adversary at this moment. And I guess, you know, I'm only allowed to say that on Beach Grit, but I've had a lot of run-ins with the Chinese and yeah, I don't especially like them. And I'm happy to go on record and say that. And, from the way they behave in buffets in Cambodia to the way they behave in airport lines, had some fisticuffs, some great fisticuffs with some Chinese nationals.
Peter, can you tell us about the fisticuffs? Because you're a kickboxer, a jiu-jitsu man.
Yeah, oh yeah. The best one was in the airport in Bangkok, and the Chinese tour leader with the flag tried to cut the whole line and I just said not today and stopped it. And then, but what was even funnier was a giant Kiwi, like hippie backpacker guy, like came to defend the Chinese. Like I was the white racist guy. So I almost had to fight him. Yeah, fucking, you know, I love the Kiwis, but you know, come on. And yeah, and so, and my old security chief, Martin Splickle, was with me, and the Kiwi didn't know it. And so he broke off and was ready to drop him with a big right hand. And it was pretty funny at the end of the day. And so I have low friends in high places in Thailand. So I knew that he could have been shuffled around from prison to prison for weeks before his embassy found him. So I was ready to eat a punch, but he was a big monstrous guy, and but I got in, like he didn't, his body language told me he didn't know how to fight. And so, you know, I kind of do the thing, I go what, and then I close the distance. And so
you go into a clinch, or do you strike
him? No, you get too close for them to hit you.
Yeah,
and then you talk close to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you say scary things
to them. Well, tell me a scary thing. Do a scary voice.
No, I don't want to.
Come on, you can't, Peter. Give us your scary voice. Go, you want to die, motherfucker? Do you want to die today? You really want to fucking die? You want to do this?
No, it's usually how far do you want to take this? We'll go as far as you want to go, and it'll take weeks for your embassy to find you.
Oh, that's good.
Right?
I like that. Yeah.
With your bodyguard, with a cocked right, ready to just lay him out. So, but anyway, then the best part was his wife realized that it was all a misunderstanding, that I wasn't, you know, that I wasn't mad at the child, whatever. But the wife then starts screaming at the husband, "You fucking cunt, blah, 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 blah." So he's getting harangued by the wife. So then he has to back down and deal with the wife. And then we're stuck in the customs line right next to each other for another 15 minutes. And yeah, so it was awkward at best.
But. did you have a, you probably didn't have a chance, but I emailed you Chaz's non-fight with his adversary, Ashton Goddard.
Yeah, I got to come down south and my next trip to California in September. And with those wonderfully long arms, I'm going to teach Chaz how to make sure nobody ever controls the inside on him again.
Before we get there, you have to talk me off the ledge of boxing. I keep telling Derek I want to learn to box, and Derek says
boxing,
no.
Boxing is not bad. Wing Chun Kung Fu is quite good for controlling the inside. And usually you just got to talk. You always have to, like, the biggest mistake you made is you let him get too close. You go, you do this, you go, hey, easy. I've never been in a fight before, but hey. And then you take those fingers and you stick them in their throat when they get in that touching area. Right
throat there. Jabbing.
No, and you go there and you push down. And then the... And then they gag and cough and all that, and then they don't really want to fight anymore.
That really quickly, though, isn't it? When you start jabbing people's throats,
that's fighting. You know what I mean? Like, I love jujitsu. The jujitsu I learned from Hicks and Gracie isn't really a lot of the jujitsu I see today, but you know, it was about fighting. You know, like, we fought, and it was a very different world back in 1992, you know, when the Gracie brothers, you know, came to California, or when Hickson broke off and started his academy on Pico Boulevard, which was, you know, that was the OK Corral.
So I'm here real quick, Derek. I'm still going to go down the boxing thing. Just it's the combination of writing and boxing.
Boxing's great. The problem is the gloves. Is that the gloves kind of turn your hands funny and they're big, and the punches, the combinations, those things are all great. But okay, the gloves, and then the thing is they're dead from the waist down. Like, they don't have legs, you know. And so you need, we'll handle it in the Santa Gopri parking lot when I'm out.
Okay, there. Perfect. Perfect.
No. I'm a great teacher. I love teaching martial arts. I still teach.
Oh, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
This is better than anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about samurai?
You're long. You're tall and long, and you're gonna have a strong side jab, straight jab. And
this is what I've been looking for.
No one will get to take you down because you're like 12 feet tall with 14 foot arms. So,
Peter McGuire, where have you been all my life?
Yeah. Well, we both have roots in Coos Bay, Oregon. So I got to help you.
What are your roots in Coos Bay?
McGuire Lumber. My dad.
That's crazy.
My dad was a choke setter.
That is insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much time did you do in Coos Bay?
No, Seaside, 3 winters, 4 winters.
Okay. Seaside is rough, but ain't no Coos Bay rough in terms of depression.
Oh, no. No. No, Coos Bay, you get the cork boot measles.
Oh, man. So
true. You know
what
that is? Yeah. That's when you get the loggers wear, these boots with they're like golf shoe boots, right? And then they take them into town on Friday night to go get drunk, and then they obviously get in fights, and then you get stomped with the cork boots, and when your face is covered with scabs from the cork boots, that's the cork boot measles. Yeah. So no, it's Oregon's a whole nother world.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah. I had a good run and had some good innings in Gearhart. So
okay, I know Gearhart. Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, yeah. So then you're perfect. You're the perfect man to train me up. Yeah. You're going to Sensei Peter from now on.
No, but what was scary was the giant, like I called the Oregon local guys overbred. Because like here in North Carolina, they're, I call them, you know, obviously, you know, some inbred. Where, but in Oregon, they're like 6'5", and, you know, Nordic monsters. And yeah, it was no joke. You had to wear a hotline wetsuit. You had to have a clear board. You had to carry your wetsuit in a bucket to the point. You had to, So it was, it was total clandestine op. Had to have Oregon plates. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And you're a sailor, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I stayed with the family who built Windward Passage.
Okay.
Windward Passage in Ticonderoga. And they were probably some of the, they won the Transpac, everything. And so in exchange for their house in Gearhart, I wrote the grandmother's oral history of the family.
Oh, that's a, that's a great one.
Oh, it was a great, it was great. I had a ball. I love Oregon. In the fall.
Yeah, in the fall. In the fall only.
Get out of there.
Only.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy what's happened to, I mean, not to go off too far afield here, but Portland in the last couple of years has been wild to watch, like from its being the paradise to it being honest to goodness hell, where it was nothing when I lived there. It was just Portland. It was the city that nobody went to and whatever. But then, so then to go there and see it, oh, wait, now it's the place to be, to then see, oh, no, this is a proper, honest to goodness, like, liberal hell.
Well, no, gunfights yesterday or Saturday. Yeah. I mean, straight up gunfights. And, you know, Proud Boys v. Black Bloc and you know, on and on it goes. But I think, you know, the Oregonians are tiring of it. And, you know, again, they're... You know, there are revolutions, there are counter-revolutions. So we underwent a cultural revolution, 2020, and there's always violence in the wake of a revolution. But you know, it's not a secure revolution, right? So I think you know things are incredibly fluid and. Things are not looking good for the Biden administration, and Harris got 1% when she ran for president in the primaries, and you know they face an uphill battle in the next election, and so you know America's very volatile right now. We're a very violent country. The bloodiest war in American history was the Civil War. And I live in the South, and you know it's very different down here. They know what defeat tastes like. They know what military occupation tastes like. So it's actually kind of much calmer here because they realize what the stakes are, and I don't think that. I think basically many, many parties in the American political game have overplayed their hand, and they're about to realize it in a very brutal way. I've been wrong before. Maybe I'll be wrong again, but I don't see this administration. They're taking on water quickly. So I worked for Senator Jim Webb, and who I quoted in that piece today. And I was really hoping that, you know, that he would become president. And he ran in 2016 as a Democrat and got something like 1% of the vote. And they asked him in one of the debates, this was kind of, you know, the end of his campaign. They said, Senator Clinton, what's the enemy you're proudest of? And she said, oh, the Republicans, when I proposed healthcare. And they said, Senator Webb, Navy Cross winner, Silver Star, 2 Bronze Stars, 2 Purple Hearts in Vietnam. What's the enemy you're most proud of? He said, well, I think it was that Vietnamese guy who threw a grenade at me, and I still have the shrapnel in me, but he's not here to talk about it today. And that was it. That was it for Webb. Dead, game, set, match. And this guy is the most qualified candidate we've got. He's written 10 books. He went to the, Naval Academy, Secretary of the Navy, Senator from Virginia, on and on it goes. I mean, great guy. You'd love to have beers with him, have a good laugh. But he was just untouchable after that. But I think, Thomas Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions talks about, and I suck at science, and this is the only thing I remember from that book. And I got through college by taking like the history of science and anything around, meteorology, anything around science. But I remember this, and Kuhn said, the greatest resistance against a collapsing paradigm or model comes at the moment before its collapse. And I think we see a lot of that today with these like incredibly aggressive pushbacks against commonsensical things. And it's almost desperation. And so, America, remains the wild, fluid country that we are, and an immature country.
Which segues perfectly into the state of professional surfing and the World Surf League. Ultimate Surfer debut tonight.
Oh yeah.
Do you follow at all the WSL and pro surfing in general or no?
Oh, of course. Well, no. The pro surfing is really boring, above all. It's just really boring. And then once it got into the aerial thing with the like shoulder wide stance and the big butt pump to do the big flip McTwisty thing. And the Olympics had that. And I was talking to George Greeno about it. And you need George on your show because he's one of the greatest of the great. And he pulls no punches. And George was, just said they get like no points for a tube ride. And then they get, they fail on 10 McTwisty things and then they get the gold medal. Like, what the fuck is this? And so once it got aerial and this and, the Brazilian storm and all that, it became very uninteresting to me. The Ultimate Surfer, we'll have to see. Kelly was, I was his first jiu-jitsu teacher. And I don't know, we'll see. ABC, lots on the line, it looks pretty punishing.
do you think there's like in terms of even not even I guess joking here but in terms of the overall like empires coming and going right and things like this, and not that the WSL is an empire or anything, but just surf culture, I think as surf culture has gone kind of through history, it does feel like we're at some point right now. I don't know what it is. But yeah, like there feels like it's coming up to a real head of something. And I don't know if it's like crusty locals versus the corporate map. I don't know what it is, but it does feel like something.
Well, again, this WSL thing is just, as long as Mr. Hedge Funder wants to keep funding it, that's great. But I think he's going to get bored of it soon. At the end of the day, it's his ROI, and I don't see much ROI on this. Like, they're not making dough, and it's.
I have intel that he doesn't care. I have hot intel that he does not care. That he doesn't care to make money on it. He's just going to sit on it. Like, doesn't care. It's his thing. Likes to do it. Good enough. Whatever.
Maybe, but he cares. Well, I recently was in the water with the great man of the WSL, and
here we go. This is what I was waiting for.
He was most frustrated by the fact that even with a what I call a surfpa, you know what a surfpa is?
No.
That's when you're a plutocrat and you hire, former great surfers to be your surfing sherpa.
Oh, perfect. Surf. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. So he had the surf puzz blocking for him. And I grew up with these guys. So like they ain't blocking me. And you know, my 14-year-old and 16-year-old and my friend's 15-year-old daughter are just lapping him, getting wave after wave, wave after wave. And he looked like his head was going to explode. He was so mad, even with a blocker. And, you know, and I was like, gosh, who's that guy? He seems very, very upset and he's used to having things his way. And so, you know, there it is. And we see more of this with the plutocrat surfing, you know, the great term you guys coined, the VALs, the vulnerable adult learners. And most are, you know, entitled and educated and upper middle class or better. And it's very interesting in the Chinese sense of interesting.
The VALs are effectively our China, just busting on the board. The VALs are effectively our China,
I believe. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny. And I get them here, even in North Carolina, you know, and they're kind of the, you know, the Patagucci set, you know, with the Patagucci gear. And what's funny is they really look the part, you know, they're really good at, they got the right board and the right wetsuit and the right this and that. So you kind of think they can surf. You're like, wow, like, oh man, this guy just paddled out. He's sitting on, and then you see in their feet are like 4 feet wide when they're paddling and stuff like that. And you're like, oh my gosh, like they spent all that time getting the whole outfit right, but they can't even fucking surf. And so, it is what it is.
Did you ever imagine when you were at G-Land, early 70s, that this would be surfing today? I mean, can you put yourself back then and think, okay, this is what surfing is.
No, that's my co-author Ritter. He was one of the G-Land pioneers.
I thought you were in Bali early too.
No. I just ghost wrote his new piece, but I'm younger. I'm 56, and so in 1984, I moved to Australia by myself, and have really never been the same. And the Australia. Yeah, absolutely. And the Australians, I mean, Ant Corrigan, Matt Elks, In the Nude, you know, Derek, you know all this stuff. I mean, this is the Bacchanalian time of Australian surfing. And so I got to go up and down the coast with Ant Corrigan and those guys and, you know, the Spit the Winkle era. And I mean, it was 50 Shades of Wrong. And but it was great. And again, I never looked at surfing the same again, because in California, if you could surf, you could get away with anything. In Australia, if you could surf and you were a dick, it didn't matter how well you surfed, like you got punished. And so and the Bondi guys, you know, were the best. And Ant was the king. I mean, Ant Corrigan was the greatest surfer of his generation. And he chose basically to work at the pub instead of going on the pro tour. And it was a great, great time. And so this stuff today, it means less than zero. You know, I surf today for 2 hours at a great surf. I still surf all the time. I go to California every trip I surf. And I love surfing, but this stuff just absolutely means nothing to me. And it's silly. And the idea that the aerial guys in Beach Break are, you know, we're going to create this game for them. It's meaningless. I would say John Florence, Jamie O'Brien, these are the guys who are interesting to me, and who, you know, just surf unbelievably well, or even guys like Eric Haas, who no one's ever heard of, but me and Jamie Brissick. I mean, you know, Eric Haas is a story unto himself. And, you know, probably the greatest. Eric Haas, probably the greatest big wave surfer I've ever seen. And I lived on the North Shore on and off for close to a decade. And that's a whole episode. Yeah. And ask Jamie about him. I mean, he, yeah, just unbelievable. He'd call me up and say, hey, you know, he lived in Honolulu. I'm taking the bus out to the North Shore. Can I borrow a board? Yeah, sure. And I'd meet him at Waimea, and, you know, he'd get off the bus at like 6:30 in the morning and is like, you know, still Saturday night fever clothes from the Honolulu bars, and put on his elastic waistband, ABC store trunks, you know, with his gut and everything, and go out at 20 foot my Waimea and get 20 waves in an hour and hand me back my board, hop back on the bus and go back to Honolulu. Yeah, you know, Eric Haas is in his own league. And he's in Dana Brown's Heavy Water. There's the whole movie's kind of built around this search for Eric Haas. And so, yeah, and he's, you know, he's in and out of the HCCC correctional facility and whatnot. So, you know, he's got his, what do we say today in our kinder, gentler America, his challenges and struggles. But we might even have a conversation about it and have some concerns.
So, we talked about the vows. I think it's a good time to swing on back to your new book, Breathe, Hicks and Gracie.
Yeah.
But there's an amazing passage in there where the Hawaiians go to Rio for a surf contest. One of the Hawaiians, I think it was Brian Amona, was it?
Yeah.
He hassles one of the local kids. I think snaps his board or punches his fins out or something.
Yeah, punches his fins out.
And then the Gracie brothers go and look for him. And from that moment on, I think the Gracies never had a problem in Hawaii ever again, did they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But they don't mind fighting. So, and the Hawaiians like fighting. And so they did really, they, you know, in Hawaii, you fight, they, you know, you get challenged, you fight back, all that. And then they hug you and love you and everything's good. And so the Gracies have fit in very well for that reason, you know, and Helson Gracie was the first one there, Hickson's older brother, you know, and he'd play soccer with all the Hawaiians and get in fights with them and stuff. And they loved him. And so, you know, it's in many ways, having seen real organized, almost genocidal violence, it's ritual violence, right? It's to see who you are, to see what you'll stand up for, what you won't stand up for. And once they see that and understand that, then they respect you and life goes on and everything's okay. But, and so that I think was the case with the Gracies, was that they saw, wow. And then they liked him and they were like, wait, we want to learn this stuff. Like, hey, and then, you know, you've got an amazing MMA culture and jiu-jitsu culture coming out of Hawaii and great fighters. And so they adopted them basically.
So can you, for people who haven't read Breathe yet,
yeah,
can you paint that picture when Hickson and the Gracies go after Brian and Brian's sitting in the backyard having a joint with Michael Ho?
And the, well, they, yeah, basically, you know, this guy, Hawaiian guy, punches the fins out of one of Hickson's friends' boards. Hickson finds out. They find out that the Hawaiians are all staying at Rico de Souza, Brazil's first pro surfer's kind of home and factory, and they invade it. And, you know, and everybody knew that the Gracies drove Volkswagens. So when five Volkswagens pull up, all the Brazilian surfboard factory workers start running for their lives. And the last guy jumps out of a bathroom window. And it's like, you know, it's like the zombies have come. And, you know, and Hickson goes in and is looking for Amona. And he's young. He's 16 or 17 years old. And he's not big. He's 150 pounds. And Amona's a big guy. And then he finds his board and smashes it or whatever else. And then the big wine comes outside and Hickson chokes him out and then chokes him out a second time. And yeah, and some of our big names of pro surfing were there. I think Mike Purpose, Buzzy Kerbox, Michael Ho, Randy Rarick. I think they were all there. And yeah, and then Amona says he's going to kill Hickson and kind of, you know, gets agitated at him at the, you know, the banquet for the contest. And an old man, Gracie, Scary Helio, you know, the father who fought a 3-hour, 48-minute fight of his own, says, no, this is absolutely unacceptable. And they go down to his hotel. And Horry and Gracie says, you know, finds him and says, hey, you know, you want to fight my brother again? That's not a problem. He's on the beach waiting for you. But this stuff of, you know, you're going to get him. Well, you won't leave Brazil. And so, and, you know, I'll be curious as to what the other accounts are, but Hickson is a straight shooter. Hickson doesn't lie or exaggerate. So I trust his account of this. I've heard others in the surfing world saying, well, you know, he was afraid to fight back because of the Gracie family and this and that. But I have a hard time believing that.
And Hickson surfs. He's a good surfer, huh?
Yeah. No, he's got some pretty serious back problems from obviously the years of fighting. So he hasn't been able to surf for a few years, but yeah, he was a very dedicated surfer his whole life and loved surfing and loved it in a way to test himself, because he basically said after a certain point, I was really only fighting against myself. I didn't have much competition. I mean, he used to line up our whole class, 30 guys, 20 of them were pro fighters, and go through every one of us like a hot butter knife, like every guy, 30 guys. And some guys would last 2 or 3 minutes. And then other times he'd come in and say, okay, today I'm only going to go for an arm lock on your right arm. And, you know, and he says in the book, like, if I got 29 guys and one guy lasted like 3 minutes and 4 seconds, I couldn't sleep. Like, I couldn't, you know, I stay up all night trying to figure out how that one guy survived. So he's a very unique guy, and he's got a big brain. He's not dumb at all. And he doesn't really like fighting. And that's why we always kind of got along, because I'd say, hey, you know, that sounds great and everything, but if I take some guy to the ground in Phnom Penh, I'm going to have like 30 people throwing concrete blocks on my head and another dozen like hitting me in the head with rebar. So that I got to take that pay. And he said, he was like, no, you take that page out of the playbook and throw it away. And so he kind of understood the kind of stuff I was dealing with and was intrigued by it, you know, and fighting on motorcycles and driving cars through roadblocks and things like that. And he kind of was like, okay, well, that's different. Let's think about that. And he was very open-minded. And in this, you know, martial arts tends to be very doctrinaire, and many other jiu-jitsu guys are kind of like, oh, well, this is this and that's the way it is. But Hickson had a very open mind, and that's why we always got along very well, and we're really good friends and still are.
Hey,
what's that?
I'm just saying, Chaz, have you seen Hickson?
Yes, I've seen videos.
He's a fucking sexy motherfucker. Check out the Bruce Weber shots from Rio.
Oh,
the absolute sexiest. And the way he, like, I mean, I have two questions on this one. The first, I'm going to ask them both at the same time, Peter. First is, was Hickson's ability to dominate, did he have just like an analytical mind where he could sort of see the movements of the body and know what they were going to do? And then you kind of own your body in that way, right? Because it's not in jiu-jitsu, it's not force ever. It's like angle and whatever. I mean, I'm
It is, but there's you know, that's true, but there's, you know, there's strength and pressure. And Hickson's biggest thing is pressure and not going in with a game plan. And basically, like, his, what he always says is like, I just take the guy and I make him squeak. And then when he squeaks, I take what he gives me. So it's not, you know, he doesn't have a game plan. It's not like this guy leads with his right side and throws a jab a lot. I'm going to, no, it's never that.
But he's seeing something in real time, right? Like he's seeing what? Like, I mean, a vision, like a heat seeking snake or whatever, where he's seeing.
Exactly correct. And that was what was most interesting about Hickson, was that when I first met him, he would look you in the eye with those terrifying, like dead black eyes. And he would shake your hand and then he would feel you up. He'd like feel your lats and everything. And and it was like, you could see the supercomputer going like threat, not, friend, foe. And it was really interesting. And I kind of came away. I was like, wow, that guy is the greatest evaluator of humans and who they are. And like, he can get right to the core of someone faster than anyone I've ever seen. And I can do that quickly because I've had to as well in work, but he did it in a way that was like nothing I've ever seen. And then he would say, oh, this guy, yes, this guy's very good kickboxer, but he's coward. And I was like, no. And you know, world champion fighters, but he would immediately like smell something weird about their motives, about their this, about the way. Yeah. And so he had a real intuitive sense that that was born from having to evaluate someone within seconds and potentially have to fight them, you know?
So then on to the second question.
Yeah.
Could you develop a BJJ of four war correspondents of like when you are getting the rebar whacked on your head? Like, because I feel for all my lack of fighting, my very clear, obvious lack of fighting, I mean, with Hezbollah, with Al-Qaeda, with anybody, I can figure out a room and can play a room.
Right.
Like, and not from Somalia to deep Yemen to wherever, right? I can play a room. I can't fight anybody. But there's something about playing a room and fighting, I feel, that's sort of similar, where I feel you could be a master of a new technique of playing the room and fighting. A whole
number one is the weapon of the mouth, the most powerful weapon we have, right?
Yep.
And my favorite one is to go like, what? And you got to leave the mouth hanging open and look slightly confused, and then you watch people's body language and it drops like, oh, this guy is a little bit, oh, he's a special needs fellow, and then that's your window of opportunity. There's that, and then there's also, and then a lot of it, especially like in rioty chaos things, it comes down to like football football and boxing and running over people and being able to run in street clothes, like 8 minute mile. Like I always made sure I could run an 8 minute mile in full street clothes, like with a bag. And I had a situation in Cambodia. They have what's called the River Festival every year during the big rain season, where all the dragon boats come from all over Southeast Asia to race in the Mekong. And then, of course, it's the wet season. So every afternoon, there's a torrential rainstorm and there's like 2 million people and there's a stampede. And like one year, something unbelievable, like 100 people got crushed to death. And this is a regular event. And so I went to the AP office to do some work, not remembering that it was the River Festival. I was staying not even 3, 4, 5 blocks away. And I came out and it was torrential rain and the crowds were pushing and shoving. And then, you know, they start stampeding and you're crushed to where you can barely breathe. And then I see these like hooligan young Cambodians with their hands on each other's shoulders, running through the crowd, like 20 of them, like a centipede. And I went, that's my exit. And I got put my hands on the last guy's arms and just got in that human train and I got out. And so those are the kind of tactical decisions you have to make when you don't really have time to think and you don't, you have to move fast and think fast and like a quick mind. I've seen great fighters that were a little bit slow. They weren't dumb, but their minds weren't fast. And you would watch a whole situation develop and they wouldn't pick up on any of it. So the fast mind that can see a bad situation developing is probably better than a panoply of martial arts skills, because you can avoid a lot of trouble before it lights up. But yeah, running, boxing, rugby, football. Yeah. These are your friends in mob violence. Yeah. So
learn Sambo, Chaz. Sambo is pretty amazing. Combat Sambo.
Yeah, but Ooh. It's on the ground.
I like Sambo.
Yeah, Sambo's good name.
Yeah, Derek wants to always get me on the ground. I want to stand on my feet and just punch.
Yeah. Oh, and you got the range. I mean, you got the range. Yeah. You got to go strong side forward, you know, so you lead with your strong hand with like a vicious straight jab, never flaring the elbow. And then that's going to be really hard for people to get past. So.
For them, Derek. Someone's just going to come in, clinch, boom. It's on the ground.
No.
Second chairs.
What we got to do, I got to train boxing, Derek. But we could sell this pay-per-view. If I train boxing for a while, you're with your jiu-jitsu. And we go old school. What were the first UFC? What were those? Yeah. Where they just would put like boxer versus whatever?
Oh yeah, that was
that's great. What we do, Derek.
We'll do Vale Chudo, Chaz.
Yeah. Well, that was much more interesting back then.
Yeah, you know? I loved it back then. I don't care about UFC. They're all doing the same thing. Like it's a thing, and I get it, and I appreciate it, and that's great. But I wanted to see the karate guy fight the boxer guy, where it was like playing toy action figures, and you always wanted to know. And clearly, the stinking Gracies owned everybody, and then it broke the whole thing. Like, so to Derek's credit, I guess, once it gets on the ground, you're over, right? Like, boxer on the ground.
Yeah, but then the American wrestlers came in. And I train a lot of wrestlers and have over the years, and they're monsters. And they have the best work ethic. And you know, they became incredible. Guys like Kevin Randleman and Mark Kerr and... I would argue some of that generation of fighters are better than anybody today. Like Boss Root, you know?
It'd be so fun if UFC was Ultimate Fighting, again, was that if they made people stay to a tradition of fighting, you weren't allowed to mix. You were a kickboxer, you were a boxer, you are a jiu-jitsu, you are whatever, and then go have at it. Because then... Yeah. I mean, the mixed martial art, I suppose, is just frankly not interesting. I love boxing. I will watch boxing all day, every day, because I don't know. I grew up with it, right? But
boxing after UFC, it's like watching children play in a sand pit or something. It seems so so consequence free after watching it.
Yeah.
What does
boxing?
Boxing?
Yeah.
Oh, boxing! But boxing's the sweet science.
No. Boxing actually is more brutal than any of them. And I boxed and it was horrible. And I got hurt worse boxing than anything because your hands are wrapped. You've got gloves on. You're not going to break your hands. And you can hit, you know, you can hit and get hit way more than the human body would allow if you were, you know, fighting barefisted. And so that's what made Vale Tudo interesting, was that it was no gloves. So that if you're throwing hands, you're going to break your hands. And we saw that in the early UFCs. All those guys broke their hands. If you hit anybody above the nose, brow, you know, that area, you know, you're going to eventually break your hands. And so, boxing's brutal. And I don't think people realize how brutal it is. And then Thai boxing is just in its own league. And those fighters are the toughest pound for pound fighters I've ever, ever dealt with. But again, they're dead from the waist down, and all their skills on their feet fail them on the ground. And so, but yeah, the Russian, American, Iranian, I mean, you know, some of these wrestlers are just unbelievable, like Khabib. Yeah, this guy's unbelievable. And
I mean, Khabib is the best ever, though, right? Like, basically unbeatable. You
know, for right now, yeah, he's the best guy right now, period. And where he fits in the big ziggurat of things, I don't know. You know, it's hard to compare. But yeah, incredible work ethic, incredible toughness.
Have you ever done your Chechnya, Dagestan, anywhere in there? Your Caucasus? Oh,
thank you.
No.
Yeah, scary. Scary. I mean, the guys that I have worked with over the years, you know, basically said, like, I had a friend who was one of the horse soldiers in the first invasion of Iraq. And he said the scariest guys they ever came up across were like blonde haired Chechens, and they were Muslim. Yeah. And they said those were the guys that they were, you know, that they were most afraid of. And so, yeah, no. The Chechens are gnarly. And
Chechnya is my holy grail of going. Like, I've been close, but I haven't been in yet. And I want to do a hard yards in Grozny. I am excited.
Yeah, Grozny. Oh, man. Go see Khabib, you know?
Yeah. He and I will have a good time together. I can talk some Muslim with him. I got him.
I have a Montagnard fighter. Do you know about the Montagnards?
No.
Montagnards are the greatest, were the greatest American allies in the Vietnam War. And these are the Southeast Asian Hill tribes. There's 30 different tribes. These are the guys who are guarding Kurtz in the end of Apocalypse Now, right? That whole scene, right? So one faction of them called the Lost Army continued fighting the Vietnamese until 1992.
Jesus.
Never surrendered. Yeah. And so an incredible reporter who, you know, like many, we don't hear much about anymore, a guy named Nate Thayer, the only guy to interview Pol Pot, kind of one of my idols. Nate was on the border of Cambodia and Vietnam. And all of a sudden, I don't know if Nate was there, but all of a sudden these guys in old tattered uniforms with old M1 Garands and stuff come out of the jungle to this UN cantonment point. And they're like, oh, you're the Americans. You brought our new weapons and our resupply. We've been waiting since 1975. We just launched an offensive against the Vietnamese last week. And I think it was Nate, but he said, well, not really. I'm a reporter, blah, 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 blah. And he turned around and poof, they're gone. They vanished. So then he went and told one of the UN guys, I think it was from one of the Spanish units, and said, fuck, these Montagnards, the Lost Army, they're still alive, man. We thought that they got wiped out in 75. So they dressed Nate as a Spanish soldier and said, oh, he's got malaria. We got to take him to Phnom Penh. And they flew a UN helicopter over the border area, and they saw a clearing of trees, and they started to go down, and all these people came out of the forest, and they were the Lost Army. And they'd been listening to Voice of America Christian broadcasts. So they were like hardcore evangelical Christians. And then began the secret evacuation of the Montagnards from Vietnam to Cambodia to North Carolina. And the old Green Berets said, fuck, those guys save more of our lives than anybody. You get them here, we'll take care of them. And it was one of the few great moments of, you know, we completely abandoned and fucked them, but we did kind of try to make up for it in the 90s, a day late and a dollar short. But nonetheless, today, North Carolina has the largest Montagnard population outside of Southeast Asia. And so one of these refugees that I probably, and I was going into their camps at the, around those times, and you know, kind of, you know, seeing what was going on and trying to help the evacuation. But one of these guys I probably saw in a UN refugee camp in Mondulkiri, Cambodia, eventually got to the United States. And now he's an MMA fighter that I coach, and he's 6-0, and he's fighting in the UFC contender series, Theo Relang.
Oh,
yeah. And these are amazing people. I mean, these are just amazing people. And, you know, one generation, his dad comes, you know, they come to, Greensboro, North Carolina, speaking no English, you know, with the clothes on their back. And in, you know, in one generation, they're all college graduates now. His dad has the most successful tree trimming business in his town, and just remarkable people. And so, yeah, so Theo fights, I think, the 21st in Las Vegas.
Oh, what's his, yeah. what's the full name?
Theo Relang. And he's, and even better, he's fighting a Vietnamese guy who chased him out of his homeland.
No. Oh, yeah. And,
not literally, but figuratively. I mean, you know, let's build up
storylines. Come on, we're writers exactly. here at the end of the day.
Yeah, so Theo's fighting a Vietnamese American, a fellow refugee. I mean, I think the world of the Vietnamese refugees that came to America, you know, the boat people, 75. I mean, just, you know, amazing model immigrants, you know. And now that we have the kind of open southern border, you know, I think we should pick and choose who gets to come in. And when I look at the Vietnamese, when I look at the Montagnards, they've been amazing, amazing American citizens, like Fofo Tetele, the Samoan Marine that I'm trying to get the Congressional Medal of Honor for, who, you know, was the hero of the Mayaguez incident, last battle of the Vietnam War, who did, I don't remember how many tours in Vietnam. He wasn't even a U.S. citizen. The guy, you know, the guy was a Western Samoan. And so there should be some kind of price for admission.
Wow. Why are some immigrants more successful than other immigrants? What's the difference?
That's hard to say. I think, I think our Hispanic immigrants have been incredibly successful, and, being a Californian, you know, Mexican culture is probably, like, when I moved to the South, I wasn't sure I could live here until I found a good Mexican restaurant, a good Mexican market. And then I immediately felt like, oh, okay, I can live here. I think, you know, we have some incredible success stories. But you know, I think Europe's facing some of these questions now, you know, where Germany in particular, you know, where we'll open our arms, we'll take all of you, and you get a deluge of single male military age men. I don't think that's going to work out well anywhere. But America now, the southern border is a complete and utter mess. And it's, I don't want to blame it on Biden. I don't want to blame it on anyone. It's America's had it both ways, right? So we had the Bracero program to bring over Mexican labor during harvest season. You know, then we had the NAFTA agreement, which basically, you know, made our border open. I mean, most of our fentanyl comes across legitimately through trucking across, you know, the main borders of America and Mexico, because it's impossible to check. I mean, there's just too many vehicles coming through. And, you know, and again, the cartels are some of the most efficient multinational corporations on earth. Like, for example, when NAFTA came down, I think in 92, 93, the cartels realized, okay, like chicken processing was once a good union job. And then globalization, let's get rid of unions, let's get rid of regulation, blah, blah, blah. So the cartels kind of realized, okay, the only Americans left in these chicken processing plants are tweakers. So let's send Mexicans to work in the chicken processing plants, and they can also sell meth. And so, I mean, it's grisly, but it's brilliant if you want to, you know, let's just
sell a product.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they beat us at our own game, you know, and, you know, again, I was a union member and it was great. I mean, I made more money working as a union laborer. I was AFL-CIO Local 300, Laborers Local 300. I worked 11 at night to 6 in the morning with Daryl Strawberry's cousins on high rises in downtown LA.
Daryl Strawberry's cousins?
Yeah. And so
that's awesome.
Yeah. And so I made more money working as a union laborer and selling weed than I made as an Ivy League professor, not adjusting for wages, anything. So I did that when I was about 17, 18 in 1982 and 3. And then, you know, 94, 5, I'm an Ivy League professor and I'm making less money. Yeah.
Do you ever regret the flip to the Ivy League to being Dr. Peter McGuire as opposed to?
No. I'm amazed that I got that PhD. That was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Yeah. That
was your dissertation war and law or law?
Yeah,
and law?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, Nuremberg trials. But it was very subversive and it took a decade to get published. I mean, I basically called bullshit on international criminal law. And that was in the 90s when it was going to be the world court and all that. And I said, listen, without enforcement, without the Security Council powers being held accountable the same way as everybody else, this is no different than Woodrow Wilson, you know, and the Treaty of Versailles. And this was a very unwelcome message. So my career started off a bit bumpy, and that's when I went to Cambodia. I was like, well, you know, I'm going to go do real field work. And my PhD advisor was Brigadier General Telford Taylor, who was the chief prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials. And so he was a stern taskmaster. It took me 10 years to get my first book published. And, rejected, you know, I would get split reviews at every publisher. And then, eventually great German historian Jürg Friedrich was one of my reviewers. And he said, no, McGuire is right. Not only is he right, I'm going to hire him. And he hired me to work for Spiegel TV in Germany on a documentary on the Nuremberg trials. And then he introduced me to all the old German defense attorneys who said, of course we freed all the prisoners of war, not war criminals. And this is how we did it. And we wrote it in invisible ink. And so, so that was really, that was interesting. And that was about the time I met Kelly in France. Yeah. Cause I would work in Germany Deutschmarks. And then I would go to France to go surfing like any spare minute I had. And then I met Kelly at the house of the Quicksilver owners in Europe.
Okay. So you got to spool this story out real quick. First meeting, first impressions and what Kelly has become. And also, I guess as a Hitler-esque figure, what he's come to represent.
Oh, Lordy. I first actually met Shane Dorian. He was staying there and he was a really nice guy. And I spoke a little bit of French. And so And I, you know, I know France. So I would drive him and take him surfing and whatnot. And we became friends. And then I said, gosh, Kelly, I've been sitting, and Shane, I've been sitting in a courtroom, you know, can I just practice some martial arts with you? So I taught him some real easy Wing Chun drills, nothing hard, nothing mean, nothing that he would get hurt or anything. And he was a wonderful guy and a great training partner and a pearl, as you Aussies say. And Shane Dorian is a truly nice guy. And then I went back to The Hague, and this was the first Bosnian war crimes trial, Duso Tadic, and a really nasty prison guard. And
I remember Duso.
Yeah, you know, and so I came back from, they called a recess. And the minute there was a recess, I'd go straight to the airport, get the first plane to France. So I get back to the house in France, and I'm in a coat and tie with a briefcase, and I'm not a big guy. And I see Shane. Hey, Shane, gosh, I've been in the courtroom the last 2 weeks. You want to train a little bit? And he says, no, but Kelly does. I said, well, that's odd. Kelly, I don't know Kelly. And then, you know, then the great man walks in, and you know, and he's kind of looking at me like a lamb chop. And I'm kind of going like, this smells funny. And he had all these rings on. I said, please take your rings off. And so we go out on the lawn, and I kind of try to teach him the same way I was teaching Shane, but he's a very competitive and aggressive fellow. And, and he's kind of throwing some heat at me, and I'm, you know, ducking and bobbing and weaving, and it's fine. I deal with that. And it goes on for a long time. And his peers, so you need a follow-up with the people who are actually there and witnessed it. But anyway, they're all kind of lurking in doorways and whatnot. And his videographer at that time was that guy, Taylor Steele. Yeah, he was lurking as well. And I felt a setup. And then he says, can we fight on the ground? And he doesn't know that I'm like a Hickson student. I say, sure, go ahead, put me in anything you want. And he puts me in a kind of bad rear naked choke. And I drop my chin and do what I need to do. But then he starts like doing this stuff and this stuff. And I was like, oh, this is a kind of a different party now. And then I just stretched him out a bit and then helped him up and said, wow, you know, you're a really competitive guy and you could be a great fighter one day. And nice to meet you. I'm going surfing. And I mean that because he really does have an incredible competitive spirit that fighters need. And he has a weird length, like he's got these long, long arms. So I think more than jiu-jitsu, he would be an incredible boxer. And that was more, that was more or less it. And then he had a contest the next day, and he didn't do well. And I think it was because he got a bit stretched out. I don't like to, guys like that are used to winning, you got to leave them with a little bit of their dignity. And that's why I'm a good teacher. Like I have some incredible athletes and incredibly competitive people. And I can beat them without defeating them. And that's why, they come back. So
it's very analogous to successful war, isn't it? That you don't completely humiliate your adversary.
Exactly. No, you leave them some dignity and, you can go unconditional surrender mode, but, it depends on the adversary really. And it depends on the war. Typically wars don't end with an unconditional surrender. And so then negotiating that peace, that dignity, that face, leaving them with that makes it much more easy to negotiate a truce, a peace treaty, whatever else. I mean, if you completely crush them, Yeah, you might win that phase, but then you've got three generations planning their revenge behind them, like the Afghans. I mean, you know, they're all about revenge. I mean, this is, you know, the, what is it, the Pashtunwali code is all about multi-generational revenge and hospitality at the same time. I mean, the guys that I know who were either smuggling weed and or hash out of Afghanistan, and the ones who are fighting in Afghanistan love the Afghans, especially the Pashto. And
I mean, the Pashto are the only ones to love, though, right?
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
The Pathan, all the other Afghanistans are just pretending to try to do something.
Like, yeah.
The Pathans are like serious about doing something.
Yeah. But no, that like, yeah, my old associate, you know, in Cambodia, you know, he, there was no group he spoke more highly of than, you know, Massoud and his gang. And not just Massoud, but just, you know, he loved the tribal area and they treated him incredibly well. And, you know, and he was in that region for like 7 or 8 years. And
it's a disaster that somebody couldn't flip it, because I think they're totally fantastic. The Afghans.
Yeah.
Pathans particularly, but like there's something winning about them that if you just suck in and let, or like sunk in, there's something there, right? Like it's not.
Yeah. No, colossal. Yeah. It was so easy, right? It was we fucked it up so bad. And
yes.
And I remember, you know, when 2001, basically going to high level US government people in the military and stuff that I know and saying, look, I have a guy who, you know, he speaks Pashto, Urdu, Dari, Sanskrit, Arabic, fought with, you know, the different tribal armies. He's ready to roll, you know? And then they would, there'd be this kind of deafening silence and I'd hear nothing. And then they'd be like, well, you know, he's not an American citizen. And I'd be like, and then, you know, and then you'd have the, you know, DevGru guys say, hey, just get him to fucking Kabul. We'll pay for him out of our own pocket. We don't even have people who can speak the fucking language. They're sending Billy Bob from fucking Jackson, you know, North Carolina, Jacksonville, North Carolina, to Monterey to try to learn Pashto in 8 weeks. And that's, you know, a tonal language that sounds like, like, you know.
I tried to learn Pashto in college on my own. It is not an easy language to learn.
No. And all the tonal languages are hard. And so, you know, that was the part that was maddening, was that, you know, the convergence of the neocons and the evangelicals and the prayer breakfasts in Washington. And like, I can't go to that party, you know, I'm a pagan, you know? So, it was just sad to watch it, you know? And,
I'm an evangelical. I should have been in that party.
Yeah,
I'm your man on the ground.
Well, yeah, you could have done it. Yeah, no, I can't go there.
I could do it, Peter. You and I, we got yards to do still.
No, well, I mean, you know, no. Like, I'm chaos and crisis are my comfort zones. So I don't know. There might still be hope. You know.
I mean, me dang too. Unfortunately.
Yeah. No, it's you know, and like we had some amazing guys, and you know, to bring us back to surfing, the great Ivan Trent, Buzzy's son, who is 100 times gnarlier than Buzzy. Like Ivan, you know, he was in the original Richard Marcinko's, you know, SEAL Team 6 dev group, like original selection. He was in every international incident, you know, from you know, the Iranian failed attempt to you know, when they got Abu Abbas where was it? It wasn't Sardinia, but in any case, it was, forget, but anyway, Ivan was everywhere. And then he retired at 48 and he was done with the SEALs. Then 9/11 happens. He reenlists and basically like Admiral Eric Olson, the head of SOCOM, has to intervene and go, no, no, we need this one on the field. And so Ivan does another like 5 years. And you know, is Ivan's the best. And
have you ever thought about screenplaying this one?
No, because that's,
I mean, you don't have to admit on the podcast.
No, but not really. You know, he's a private guy and that stuff I kind of have to keep sidebarred. And one, if
they this is the stuff that inspires future generations, yeah, right? Like it's these movies, yeah, that you sit and watch as an 8-year-old, yeah, where you think, I want to be that guy.
Yeah, no, no. And he, I mean, and he trained, you know, what was amazing about Ivan was that his bud students, Basic Underwater Demolition School at Coronado, he was a legendary instructor that they called Instructor Blah. And, you know, with the monotone, always monotone, everything. And, you know, so all the 9/11, or many of the 9/11 hero SEALs were Ivan's bud students. And then Ivan goes downrange with them as like a senior citizen on the battlefield with them. So that's pretty impressive.
Yep.
And, yeah, no, he is a dangerous man.
Clint Eastwood movie right there.
Yeah.
I can't believe you got a Boo Abbas. And for people that don't know Boo Abbas, he was the mastermind of the Achille Lauro.
Yeah. And it was Sicily was where I think the plane went down and Ivan was in a little bird, you know, with him in the crosshairs. And then there was a standoff between Delta, DevGru, and the Italian Carabinieri. They almost had a shooting war because the Italians wound up letting him go. And we were trying to catch him. And so, and any time you mention an international incident to Ivan, he'll be like, oh yeah, that time in Sicily, you know, and you're like, you know, you're like Zelig. And so, there's some amazing, you know, it's kind of like, Lieutenant Colonel and below, we should just promote them all to generals because they're the great, you know, these are the great Americans, you know, who really did the heavy lifting in the war on terror. It was the leadership failure, much like the Vietnam War, and the politicians that are always going to be politicians. And in the piece that I sent you guys today is, just very odd, the kind of neocons and the humanitarian hawks who don't serve in the military, whose kids don't serve in the military, but yet ask, you know, the military to do this incredible heavy lifting. I mean, I counsel veterans and I counsel guys who did 5 combat tours, you know, who went into the Marines as virgins at 18 and, 5 tours later, their whole youth is chewed up and, they're PTSD, you know, and then some, and, and then they get them on a zillion different pills and that doesn't help. But we've made a real mess of this and there needs to be some reckoning for it. And as I wrote today, I think that the architects, the enablers, the cheerleaders, we need to kind of remember who they are and hold them to account. It's time for a reckoning. And a reckoning doesn't necessarily have to be legal. We'll never have a Nuremberg-like reckoning, but we might have some, you know, much more painful on the one hand, some kind of what I call therapeutic legalism, like, you know, touchy-feely Truth and Reconciliation Commission or something. But I think for us to move forward, we need to kind of take stock of how much blood and treasure we have lost and prestige, as you said, Derek. I mean, to have, you know, the British and the French just completely outperforming us in Kabul right now, is embarrassing, because it isn't like we don't have the talent and the people with the capabilities to do exactly the same thing. We don't have the leadership. So that's where we're kind of falling down.
Fuck.
But let's go back to surfing. Let's end it on surfing, guys.
Come on. Surfing. So I had a little surfing question for you.
Let's go Australia. Let's go deep Australia.
Deep Australian surfing, Derek.
Surfing. Remember surfing? Fuck, but surfing. Peter, all your war crimes investigation and all that sort of shit in Cambodia and everything onto surfing. How has surfing changed in your lifetime? And what behaviors do you see in the surf that are human behaviors that you witnessed at Nuremberg and Cambodia?
Well, first I would say that, you know what the greatest cure for PTSD was?
Ketamine.
It was going from Cambodia directly to Australia and staying with George Greeno and going from being worried about being kidnapped and killed by the Khmer Rouge to being worried about being eaten by giant sharks at Outside Flat Rock with George. Because we used to surf the sharkiest places in Australia that I wouldn't dare surf now. And Cape Byron and, you know, Outside Flatty and all that. And so, yeah, but your bigger question, I think now surfing's just a funny thing, and that it's kind of become, you know, this sort of upper class, at least, you know, in some of these regions of California, the vowels that you guys so wonderfully characterized, you know, they think they're kind of owed something, or that I'm supposed to give you a set wave because it's your turn. And even though you farmed three waves in a row, so that's the part, like, I like that harsh hierarchical world of surfing that I grew up in, that was that, you know, you earned your stripes, and, you know, they were, the older guys were really mean to you, but once you kind of got there, you know, you then got to be mean to the next generation. And academia was like that as well. And I'm writing a piece now called The Anti-Socratic Revolution in American Education. And I talk about how, you know, we've replaced excellence and rigor with the perception of safety and comfort. And this is just laughable stuff. And that's why I largely don't teach anymore, because, you know, I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Paper Chase with John Houseman about law, Harvard Law School, but, you know, my professors were way scarier than him. And that was the way I taught for years. And you know, now I'm kind of like, I'll teach history of surfing. I teach it at University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and I enjoy it. It's fun, but I'm a stand-up comic. I'm an entertainer. I'm not like, I'm filling seats. And then we're held hostage to student evaluations and this kind of nonsense. And because the
jazz hands up there, that was good.
What's that, jazz hands? Yeah, and jazz. So. Because
it might upset some people.
But yeah, and so that's what's funny, is that the students have power over their professors now in what I call the culture of complaint. And in the culture of complaint, you know, the students are empowered, you know, to anonymously complain, and then those complaints are held over our heads. So due process is gone. I don't know who my accuser is. I don't even know what I'm accused of. Yet I'm accountable. And the piece that I'm writing now is just horrifying, because a professor who's anonymously accused and goes through these, you know, 10 months of star chamber courts, commits suicide with a nail gun, and his family's now suing the university for a conspiracy and many other things. And that's going to go before the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And I'll have a piece on that in probably the next week.
Holy fuck. That's a cheery story, man.
Yeah, you know, that's my bread and butter. Happy little Mary. They call me Little Mary Sunshine.
Hey, Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh, yeah, Peter, so fantastic.
All right, well, you get ready. I'm going to get that big. Are you right-handed or left-handed?
Right-handed.
All right, good. That big right lead. Nobody's getting past it.
I cannot wait. How tall are you? Literally, huh?
How tall are you?
Probably 6'3".
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 80 inches.
Derek, screw you and your jujitsu. I get a punch.
Yeah, then you.
Well, Derek, when are you coming to the States, Derek?
I think we've locked down for the next few years. So,
Derek's in jail.
Yeah, I'm in jail. Oh, man. I'm in jail.
That's all good. Right. Well, yeah, I got some good jujitsu teachers for you when you come to the States. Fuck,
but also, I need a leg up because I think me v Derek is going to be the. I'll take. Well,
you gotta go to the greatest. Non-Gracie, in my opinion, probably the greatest martial arts teacher in Southern California is Chris Howder.
And where's he?
He's in Redondo Beach. He was, okay. I think, probably the first Gracie black belt. But like me, he's also a black belt in Jeet Kune Do. He was a high-level boxer, boxing coach, you know, trained with Dan Inosanto, the one who inherited Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do. And Chris Howder is the best. And
okay.
And he's a fighter. And so yeah, you may have to come up and go to the famous, Howder's Garage.
Okay, Howder's Garage, Derek.
Oh, yeah.
Screw you, man.
Cool. Go tomorrow.
Yeah.
Go tomorrow?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm literally going to call him right now.
Yeah, he's getting fast tracked, Derek. Okay. I got a few associates in Australia. So
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Send me a little email that he got in Sydney because right now we're in lockdown. So I've been rolling on the beach.
Yeah.
Which is great because you end up with sand in your eyelids and in your ears and shit.
Yeah. And so how long have you been training?
Just over a year now.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. Been doing it, be going 6 times a week and just loving it.
6 times a week.
Yeah. Love it.
Wow. Bro. Don't get hurt. Yeah. Don't get
an addict.
I'm so shit at it, man.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be careful though. You were getting older, you know.
Yeah. No, especially if you're doing that.
Yeah.
The body of a ferret. Hey, Peter, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you guys. It's a pleasure.
We can stay.
All right. I hope I didn't bore your audience with too much international relations, but.
Hell no. It's what they're begging for.
Nah, you got to get George on because you got to get him to talk about Kelly's wave puddle, as he calls it. The Olympics. I mean, yeah, Greeno's the best. He's a living treasure that needs a forum.
Okay, thank you.
So are you, Peter McGuire.
All right. Good night, guys.
Good night, sir.
Bye-bye. Good night.
If you're into sports betting, Bet Online is where you should go to win money today. Whether it's live bets, during games, or futures for who you think will win the championship, Bet Online has all the latest odds, news, and information for all your online sports betting needs. Chaz, do you throw your money away betting?
I wish I could more easily. This is the problem, is I'm always looking for somewhere easy to throw my money away sports betting because I always think that I've got a sure lock on a game and nothing feels better than knowing you have a sure lock and throwing money down, right? How often do you sports bet?
I jump on the surfing occasion. I always lose because I can't ignore long odds. I see long odds and I just see ding, ding, ding.
But that's, I mean, the whole point of betting is long odds, right? Like who wants to ever go, like playing the book to me is the most insane part about gambling because ain't gambling, I got a gut feeling on something. Even from anything, right? I mean, most sports betting, but even let's bring it all the way back to blackjack, is sitting and playing the book where you're at the table and you know, okay, I'm holding a 17, but ooh, I got a gut that a 4 is coming up. And you know that everyone at the table hates you when you say, hit me, because you're not supposed to do that. But I don't understand anyone hating on anyone taking the longest odds in any time.
The blackjack example is perfect because you have these people playing a game that's designed for them to lose And yet they play this, they play that thing where you don't draw on, 14 or above.
No, you play the book. That's all you do is play the book.
And then people are furious.
And you see, how mad do people get in front of you when somebody else would not play the book?
And I used to sit and go, you guys are idiots. And then quite often, you pull out, 10, you 4, you 3, you 2, you 3, whatever, and get 21. If someone had been pulling all those shortcuts, the only way it works is if you can card count.
I mean, card count and or got a sweet gut feeling, which is sports betting is all about.
What's it feel like? Tell me what it feels like. Tell me that gut.
I mean, when you just have that tingle in your gut, when you know, for example, I was in Italy not too long ago, knew full well Italy was going to take the Euro Cup. I knew they were going to beat England. I just knew it. And if I had a nice app that I could have easily bet or a nice website that I knew I could have bet, I would have full on thrown down. It's just, I never know where to go in this instance.
Well, now you know. So visit the website today or use your mobile device to join and receive a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. So before your next big game, head on over to BetOnline and start playing today. BetOnline, the online sportsbook experts, and it's betonline.ag. Very important.
So wait, betonline.sportsag.
No, BetOnline, BTO, whatever, .ag. So it's Antigua.
That's it. You don't even need a .com.
BetOnline.ag. Come visit beautiful Antigua and Barbuda.
I mean, who doesn't want to bet in Antigua?
We love Barbuda. We love your women.
Who doesn't? That's where I want to throw all my money away.
Welcome to Antigua. Tattooed on your dear car.
Making people's millions.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.